it's hard to come up with the right term to describe Utah's housing market right now. I mean, there are words like booms and bubbles that economists could use, but they're not quite right. We heard a lot of words this week like insane and nuts and bonkers. And in fact, one analyst we spoke with said, try crazy or crazy crazy. That was Dayan Eskich, who studies the housing market at the University of Utah. And he has his own story with this crazy market. He studies this stuff for a living, so he understands what it looks like on paper. But it was when it got personal that it got real.
In the last year, I've been in the market myself trying to find a home and thought I would maybe have an edge because I study this on a daily basis. But when you're making the decision for yourself, you end up doing a few rational things that you probably wouldn't have do as if you were looking at from an investor perspective. I was able to purchase a condo in end of 2013 with the remainder of my student loan. Got married, had a kid. Our plan was to stay there for maybe 5-6 years. COVID happens, and you're like, I want more space. Then the earthquake happens, and you're on the sixth floor of a 15-story building that was built in the 60s, and you're like, oh, you know. We sold in August, moved in with our in-laws. We really didn't start looking till late September, early October. That fall, the market just accelerated. You were like, what happened? That house was $50,000 cheaper 3 months ago. The first home we saw, we were like, okay, this is our home. We're making an offer. It was right after Thanksgiving. It sold like 60 over asking. We were nowhere near competitive.
How'd that make you feel?
Emotionally drained, defeated. You're kind of thinking like, what am I doing? Should I wait? My day job says, don't wait. Do it now because it's about to get worse. My emotional side is like, just wait. It'll be fine. You go to home two. You look later. You talk to your agent. You're like, wow, they paid 100 over what I offered. And it was cash. We finally get to the first week of April. Easter weekend, we went to like a couple of dozen open houses, lines down the block. I remember that weekend because I've had it up to here. I told my wife, like, let's just make these crazy stupid offers and see if we get one. We found 3 or 4 homes we're going to make an offer on. We made these contingencies where we said, we're going to make up the appraisal value. Our earnest money will be non-refundable upon acceptance, and we won't ask for any repairs. Our agent called us Easter night, actually. She called us, said, I know you guys have gotten numerous rejections, but you want to know what's different about this one? Oh, no. We got it. My wife was excited. She started crying. I was more terrified. You know, it shifted from we're never going to buy a house to am I happy about this that I just paid over $100,000 of my initial budget? And of course, we got the most expensive house. The house that I was like iffy on and that I know needs a lot of repairs, but it was in our dream neighborhood, basically. We haven't moved in yet because we're doing some repairs and, you know, you can't find anybody to come fix your house. And if you do find somebody, they can't get the materials for a month. So it just kind of, we got a house and we'll get into it eventually. This is one of the toughest housing market we've ever had. And it's very scary for a lot of people.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about houses. Not just how expensive they are or how hard they are to come by, but what it means when a growing percentage of people who live here can't afford one. Because, as one of our guests told us, when we're talking about housing, we're talking about us, how we organize our society, what we aspire to. So let's begin by getting our bearings. What is going on? which is exactly the question we asked Candace Taylor, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. She said, whatever it is, we've never seen it before.
What has happened in the past year in terms of housing is absolutely unprecedented. And it's just been a really, really bizarre 12 months in terms of the housing market. So that said, basically, in the post-COVID landscape, well, it's not post, it's still going on. Yeah. But now that the worst of the pandemic is hopefully over, what happened is we had a massive surge of people wanting to buy homes for a variety of reasons. A major one is low interest rates. Right.
Yeah.
But also there were people who were living in, you know, small apartments in big cities who wanted to get out to the country and live on an estate with land where they didn't have to see anybody. There were people who were simply stir crazy. I think that is a lot of it, actually, that we don't talk about a lot. And so what happened is there is just this massive wave of people who, you know, once those initial lockdowns lifted, who all at the same time all decided that they wanted to buy homes. And it's just created, you know, skyrocketing prices across the country. It's created bidding wars, you know, 10, 20, 30 offers on the same home. And it's made it really, really difficult, especially if you're a first-time buyer. Because if you're a seller, then you're going to be able to sell your house really easily and you're going to get a very high price for it, probably higher than you ever thought. And then you could, you know, if you want to buy something else, you can take that profit and go buy something else. But yeah. If you're a first timer and you don't have that money to roll over into a new purchase, it's really tough right now.
We'll talk more about what's driving this here in a second. But explain what this is like for buyers. In one article, you profiled this couple in their mid-20s, this Dominic and Brooke. They're getting married.
Yes.
They want to find a house in, you know, the area where they grew up. Makes sense. Talk about what the experience was like for them, because it seems incredibly frustrating.
Absolutely. I think Dominic and Brooke, I think at the point when I spoke to them, they had put in more than 20 offers on homes.
Wow.
And where they live, you know, Allentown, this is not normally a hot real estate market, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think those of us who live in New York or maybe in Silicon Valley, we're sort of used to these bidding wars and things, but this phenomenon is really happening all over the country right now. That's part of what is so strange about it. But yeah, I think they just were putting in offer after offer and getting outbid on everything. And it's so frustrating, especially in a market where people aren't expecting this. Right? I mean, this is something that they've never seen before. And their parents were kind of saying, what are you guys doing wrong? This never happens in our market. We don't have bidding wars like this.
So I'm just looking at some of the numbers in your reporting of housing prices going up. And we're not talking, you know, big cities or high profile cities. I mean, the average list price of a house in Allentown, where you were reporting that particular story, 24% it goes up. Kendallville, Indiana, it seems like a kind of a random sort of city, 56% mm-hmm. prices are going up.
Yep.
Martin, Tennessee, small city outside of Nashville, about 150 miles outside of Nashville, housing prices went up 159%. So these rates seem insane.
It really is, you know, just mind-boggling. And, you know, the reason that I picked those specific places for that story is because they're not the places that you would think of, right?
Yeah.
Like you would expect, you know, in the close-in suburbs of Nashville, for example, that is a very, very hot market, right? You might expect something like that, you know, in maybe in Salt Lake City suburbs where you guys are.
Yeah.
I would imagine that is a very, very hot market as well.
Oh, for sure.
What I was kind of looking at in this piece is just how far this phenomenon has gone beyond just the places where we initially saw this, you know, like Cape Cod or, you know, Aspen, the places where initially you had a lot of rich people kind of running from COVID almost, right? This has gone very far beyond that. And there are a bunch of different reasons for that. I think a major one is the low interest rates and the investors, which we can get to later.
Well, let's talk about that now. Who's doing the bidding? Because it's not, as you say, just people looking for a house to live in. They're bidding against investors. I mean, there's been reporting about, you know, you're seeing these investors who are, some of them are just sort of seems to run the gamut, sort of the novice amateur investors. But then you have these big pension funds and private equity firms entering the market now. To talk about who's doing the bidding here.
You have everything from somebody who owns like two or three houses maybe that they rent out to, you know, Blackstone, companies like that. And what we've seen with interest rates so low, it's been hard for them to get the yields that they're looking for in other types of investments. So that's why buying single family homes and renting them out, that has been a very appealing business for them in the pandemic, especially with the real estate market so hot. But what happens is, of course, investors are much more likely to be able to use cash, right? Because they have a lot of resources. A lot of times you have a family that wants to move into a house and they're bidding against, you know, an investor who can use cash and who, you know, isn't so worried about the condition of the house because they have plenty of resources to renovate. All of this has resulted in a scarcity of homes on the market.
What do we know that they're doing with these properties? Are they flipping the houses? Are they renting them? Are they holding on to them? What are they doing?
From my understanding is right now, a lot of the strategy is buying and renting them out because obviously the housing market's really tight and you can get high rents right now. And then most likely the strategy will be to sell them down the road in a few years.
This was interesting in your reporting. You mentioned that with the stakes as, you know, as high as they are right now, house is definitely not one of those things that you should rush into. But in this current environment, it seems like it's one of those things that where you have buyers who they're worried about being outbid. They seem rushed. And so you mentioned they forego inspections and other parts of that sort of due diligence process that you usually go through when you're buying a house.
Absolutely. That is another huge thing that we've seen happen. People are waiving their right to an inspection. They're waiving their mortgage contingency, meaning if they can't get a mortgage, then they're still on the hook for their deposit. They're waiving their appraisal contingency, meaning that if the house doesn't appraise for the price they've agreed to pay for it, they still have to buy it, right? Which is going to be a problem for your lender.
Yeah.
All of those things, it's very common now for buyers to be expected to waive all of those. And then on top of that, pay cash. So that's, you know, really hard for a regular sort of home buyer to do. And it's also kind of a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. I'm not sure how much you can say about this, but around here in the Intermountain West in particular, there's this impression that another one of the big drivers of the housing price spike is this
California,
this wave of disaffected Californians selling their houses, you know, for tons of money, looking for places that are more laid back, maybe more rural, and where they can get a lot of house and property for their money. What do you know about that particular angle?
Well, that is absolutely true. That's certainly happening, not just in Utah, but in a lot of states in the West. Idaho is seeing a ton of Californians. And that is happening, you know, largely because of the work from home phenomenon, right? These people don't have to live anymore in Silicon Valley, you know, or LA. I mean, you have a lot of companies saying they're not going to be calling their workers back into the office. So all of a sudden, people are saying, gee, I can live somewhere that's much cheaper or that maybe has much lower taxes or just has a quality of life that's a lot better. You know, and as you pointed out, if you've just sold a property in California, you're going to have a lot more cash on hand to be able to compete in some of these bidding wars, you know, and the prices, like you said, do seem cheap in comparison. So you definitely have that effect happening in Utah and a lot of the other, you know, nearby states.
Yeah. This is a more kind of abstract angle, so I'm not sure what you can say about this either, but I'm wondering what it means when housing prices rise dramatically in, you know, in a rural community or in a small town in the East or Midwest. Any sense, Candace, about how this may alter, you know, the kind of economic equilibrium of a community, you know, the balance of, you know, different income levels and racial diversity? Any sense of how that may be altering the sense of that part of a community?
Well, I mean, that is a great question, but I am not sure how long this whole thing is going to last. I suspect we may be in, I'm not sure if bubble is the right term, but a temporary moment in the housing market. Housing prices are not expected to drop anytime soon, but the pace of growth actually is already starting to slow. I know it doesn't feel like that for a lot of people trying to buy a house right now, but those prices that went up and up and up and up since 2020 are now starting to grow at a slower pace. And within the next year, 2 years, prices are expected to get back to sort of normal levels of growth.
One real estate consultant told your colleague Ryan Dezember in the paper that this situation with these, you know, these capital firms competing with young couples for houses could mean that the U.S. housing market is going to be, this is how he put it, permanently more expensive. In other words, it doesn't seem to be going away. These, you know, it may settle in a bit, but it's going to be permanently altered. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question right now. Huh. What is the future of the housing market going to look like? And, you know, in other countries, like in England, it's much more common to rent a home than it is here. And, you know, home buying is much more expensive there, right? And so folks here are starting to say, well, maybe that's, you know, what we're going to be moving to. Maybe buying a home is going to be out of reach for the average family.
Yeah.
I am not convinced of that, because I think a lot of those investors, you know, when interest rates go back up and they can start getting better yields in other sectors, I think that they will move on to other types of investments and hopefully stay out of the housing market a little bit. I also, you know, I think there's just kind of a frenzy going on right now where a lot of people are just sort of desperate and thinking emotionally rather than logically. And it's sort of like once you've gotten beaten on, you know, outbid on a couple houses, it's hard to think straight, right? Because then you want to win that bidding war. And so I think right now there's sort of a groupthink going on where everybody feels like they need to buy a house. And I think when the pandemic settles down a little bit, I think people will, have a little bit more time to think. And we're actually already starting to see that in some areas. I've heard from brokers that now that people can travel again on the weekends, they're not as focused on house hunting all weekend. Huh. Or now that they can go on vacation or they can see family that they haven't seen in a year, that some of those buyers are kind of taking a break from the market or they just don't have quite as much urgency as they did when we were all like trapped in our houses with nothing to do but look at Zillow. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I do think in some areas, ultimately, people who paid crazy high prices for these houses are not going to be able to sell them for the same prices down the road. I do see that happening in some of these areas where you just saw such a huge run up in price so quickly. And I think that once, you know, all of the perfect storm of the pandemic and the low interest rates and all of that fades, I think you're going to see prices come back to a more sort of normal level.
Candace Taylor, she covers real estate across the country for The Wall Street Journal. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is proud to be a listener-supported public radio station. We'd like to thank our community of more than 10,000 sustainers who make a monthly contribution to the station, starting at just $5 a month. Because of your support, all the news, stories, and conversations that you hear are independent, calm, and commercial-free. If something you heard on KUER made a difference to you recently, become a new sustainer or increase your existing pledge at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're trying to make sense of the insane housing market today. What does this moment mean, not just for the economy, but for the shape of neighborhoods and for the chances of ordinary Utahns to be able to own a home? Because we have never seen numbers like this for housing prices and competition and affordability. But let's focus on Utah now. We spoke this week with Katie McKellar, a reporter at the Deseret News. She's been writing about the housing market. Also with us was Dayan Eskidge. He's a senior research fellow at the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute here at the University of Utah. And we began the conversation with the same question we put to Candace Taylor. What's happening right now?
We went from a pre-COVID crazy housing market to a super crazy housing market. Every time I look at new monthly sales data, I have to do a double take where you kind of laugh at it and you go, like, this can't be right.
Give me a number that you looked at recently that made you where your jaw dropped.
The one thing that stood out to me is Summit County and looking at their price appreciation. They went in 1 year from like 800s on the median sales price home to 1.2 million. And so that's about a 43% increase.
Wow.
And so, you know, you can talk about big percentage increase in lower markets where your house price goes from 150 to 200. But when you have what was the state median price a year ago, basically, that's the 1 year change in just one county. It's pretty staggering. And across the state, really, we've seen Washington County really blow up. You know, pre-pandemic, the median price was in Washington County was about 340 for a house. Salt Lake County, for reference, was about 360.
Yeah.
So now, you know, we're in the high 470 range in Washington County, and we're hitting, you know, close to 500 in Salt Lake County.
In Salt Lake County. So, Katie, you're talking to people who are seeing these numbers go up. So what's the general just sense of people that you're talking to, your sources, the people you're interviewing?
Yeah, I talked to some home buyers this spring who really wanted to get in a house, and they realized very quickly that the competition out there just to buy a house, like they were looking for a house in Davis County, is insane.
That seems to be the word, right?
Yeah.
Crazy, insane.
Unprecedented.
Unprecedented.
They were facing, you know, dozens and dozens of people looking at the same houses. Their realtors telling them, if you want to have a reasonable or competitive offer, you need to, the norm now is offering, in some cases, $20,000 to $30,000 more, if not more.
Yeah.
And they talked to me about putting in 10 offers and just one after another getting shot down. And each time it's more and more heartbreaking because they walk into this house and think, this could be it. This is where I can see raising my daughter. Mm. And to deal with that, it's hard for people looking to buy a house. And that's just the competitive nature of it. Add into the fact that they're paying thousands of dollars more, tens of thousands of dollars more for these houses that would have been way more affordable maybe 3-5 years ago.
Yeah. And having to make compromises.
Or 1 year ago.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Compromises on inspections and stuff that you normally would say, no, you got to fix that before I buy this. People are like, are you kidding? There are 10 others who are interested in this house, so you need to make the call. I think one of the things you said, Katie, in your article was people who normally spend, you know, days and days making one of the most important decisions of their lives, they're having to make it in some cases, hours.
Yes, yes. That's the nature of this climate for these home buyers. And it's kind of a reality they've had to accept. It's exciting looking to go buy a house, but they do. They have to make these life-changing decisions in a matter of hours. They don't have time to wait a couple of days to think, oh, is this really the house we want to spend our lives in, raise our children in? It's not easy.
Is Utah in any way different than any other place in the country? Is everyone going through this same kind of thing, do you think?
Yes and no. So you look at especially places like Boise, you know, when we look at the national level data, those type of markets that aren't typically in like the top 10 in terms of rate of growth. Now, all of a sudden, these, you know, lower population markets start popping up as number one, two, three from like, you know, northern Utah to Boise to eastern Washington to some places in the south, you know, places you typically don't see when you're looking at the data. So it's been a frenzy everywhere. And, you know, we've dealt with this problem for the better part of the decade, but, you know, we've really compressed like 5 years worth of price acceleration and pain in 1 year.
I mean, I've seen how this is exploding in Texas, in Florida, in a lot of different places. But I do wonder if the West is different, like the Intermountain West, Utah, Colorado, Idaho, even Arizona and Oregon and Washington, as you said. It seems like those do seem to be really
– Yeah, and part of that is from the last kind of recession that we had in the mid-2000s, the West broke out in population growth and employment growth. We, you know, Utah led the way in the rate of change for population and employment. And so, and when you kind of look at that heat map, there's kind of the almost as like the Rocky Mountain range goes, that's kind of where the big accelerations are. And part of that is employment driven growth and population growth. So, you know, on one hand, it's like, great, we have this, you know, robust economy, robust growing place, but the consequence of that is housing prices really became a policy issue and unaffordability as a result.
Well, that's the it seems like the give and take, the good and the bad of all of this, the upside downside part that we'll get to in a minute. One sort of place of interest I wanted to ask Katie about, you've reported on Heber City and how it's been listed I think top five of the cities in the country that are hot, experiencing the most net in-migration?
Yeah, it's put Utah on the national map as far as in-migration goes. The New York Times had a list of about 926 metro areas. And Heber City's right up there, I think number five on that list. And it's pretty crazy because it's showing that these people who are moving out of maybe areas like New York or California, San Francisco, you know, these expensive areas. Heber was one of those cities that they kind of discovered as an appealing place to move here in Utah. But it's this appealing area. I talked to someone who moved there about 5 years ago or 6 years ago now. Kind of felt like they discovered this neat little gem in Utah. Being out of the bad air quality, enjoying the mountains. It wasn't very busy.
Not far from a big city.
Yes, not far from the big city or the airport and close to skiing. And I talked to him again, and he talked about how, well, it doesn't feel like that small little town anymore. It's getting discovered. It's growing. There are more higher density projects coming in. There's more traffic issues. So even Heber City's booming, and it's getting crazy.
What are the terms you use to explain what's going on? Is it, you know, you hear word, it's a bubble, it's a boom, it's an explosion. And the other question is it a panic? You know, are people being rational? If you could ever say they are rational in any sort of economic burst.
So we as humans tend to have some biases where we, when we experience an event that we've experienced before, we assume it's for the same reason. So the term housing bubble now, you know, if you go on YouTube and, you know, some of the housing economists are calling these people housing bubble boys. So they are feeding into the fear, right? And if bigger institutions, journalistic institutions start picking up on this, you know, public opinion can turn the housing market negative, you know, if everybody thinks it's going to crash. Yeah. You know, you're going to manifest it. But what's really the difference in this aspect is, one, we have a housing shortage. Like I mentioned earlier, we overbuilt last decade. As we've come out of it, developers pulled back. You know, we lost a lot of headway on the housing. The housing industry got destroyed. So we couldn't catch up. So, you know, our population kept growing, but the number of housing units we delivered was shrinking.
Yeah.
And so as of, you know, this year, our latest estimate, the housing shortage in Utah is about 44,500 units. It peaked or it bottomed out in about 2017. We were in the 55,000 range. So we've made up some ground the last 3 years where we've had more units delivered to the market than households formed. So that's good. But the way I like to – We're still behind. You know, it's like we're on a boat that's treading water and we took a jug of water out and we're like – yeah, we're positive, but we still have a long way to go. We're still growing, you know. So we not only have to make up the imbalance from the last 10 years, but we still have to accommodate the new growth that's coming on. So that creates a very competitive market.
Yeah.
And what we also need to talk about is the existing for sale market, you know. That market really suffered the last year in terms of supply. So if you look at, you know, if you go to utahrealestate.com and they have like active listings, you know, the last 5 years we're somewhere in the 8,000 to 9,000 range. You know, today we're just shy of 3,000. So we have this huge disparity in that supply as well. So that's why you're seeing, you know, when you go to open house, you wait an hour to get into the house.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in that aspect, and also days on market, you know, we're typically, you know, the last couple of years, we've been in the 2 to 3 week range, depending on seasonality. We've been for this better part of the last 9 months in single digits.
5 days, first quarter of 2021.
5 days. We're now at 6 days, so maybe we bottomed out. So there's a silver lining there. But that's really what I look to as the, like, is the market returning to a normal crazy when we start getting that days on market back into the teens? That's what we're
And do you think it is?
Not yet.
Yeah, not yet. Katie, you've written about what might be described as a kind of the downside to all of this. There are reasons to be bullish on Utah, but for another segment of the population, if you're trying to get into the market, what's the outlook for you? Because affordability has become an issue now. It's all out of whack right now. Talk about that people realize the home they had in mind, that they had envisioned, it's out of their reach right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's sad. I mean, I even have family members who were told by a loan officer they could afford a house about 5 years ago. They made the decision to wait, and now they're regretting it because now they can't afford it. Wages are not going up at the same pace. If you're a renter, rental prices are also going up. It's not as crazy as house prices, but it is still steadily going up as it has been for years. And they're already maxing out their budgets on rent. How can they afford to save for a down payment for a house? And that was before this crazy market. They're seeing a house that would have been reasonable for them in their area near their job go out of reach. Think about kids leaving college or grandkids wanting to live near their families. They're realizing they just can't get the bang for their buck out here in Utah. They're looking at other states.
In a way they wouldn't have dreamed of in the past.
Probably. Yeah, I was talking to a mother who has an apartment, and her daughter was living out of state, and she wanted to come and live near her mother for moral support after she lost her infant at birth. And she was looking to buy, realized that was unreasonable, even was looking to rent and couldn't find a unit. And just thought, her mother said she told her that, I just feel like I'm trying to make something happen that's not supposed to happen for me. And so she's still out of state and, you know, away from her mother during this difficult time. People are having to make really hard choices. They're having to sacrifice, and they're just having to give up their dreams, at least for the time being.
Pre-COVID, about 68% of renters were priced out of the median priced home. As of this last month, we're up to 80%. So if you're a renter, you're stuck. When you're competing in an environment where people are bringing cash 20-25% down, asking for, you know, no repairs, you're really left with like a tiny little, you know, pot of choice, like playing Hungry Hungry Hippos with one ball.
Right.
You know, so it's daunting because we as a nation, we're especially the middle class, that's where our wealth is stored, is in our home equity. And so you're having a third of Utahns not being able to kind of participate in that aspect of the economy. So it really creates, you know, downward effects of what is generational wealth going to look like in 10, 15, 20 years if people can't if they can't find another means to build their wealth.
What are the stories about all of this that interest you as a reporter looking at all of this? Are you looking for, like, is this a powder keg that might go up at some point? Is there going to be conflict? Like, how do you think it's going to shake out as you start thinking about stories?
It's difficult because we used the word scary earlier about how sustainable is this, these home prices. Same question about rents. At what point do these prices really push a lot of Utahns to the financial breaking point? At what point does it really wreak havoc on our homelessness system? Mm-hmm. At what point, you know, does something have to change? I think we're already behind the curve, obviously, with our housing gap. And we're already seeing strains on our freeways and our traffic systems. Like, people are here. They need places to live. There needs to be solutions. We're already behind the curve. Something drastic needs to change, and I don't know if any one person has that solution yet, but zoning is a big issue. Jim Wood at the U talks about how housing affordability is a policy problem, and what is the policy to solve that? He said it starts with a Z, and that's zoning.
That's Katie McKellar. She's a reporter with the Deseret News. Also joining us was Dayan Eskich. He's a senior fellow at the Kim C. Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
I'm Scott Simon. What's that old saying, make lemonade out of lemons? How about making your favorite shows out of your old lemon? I know, it's a stretch, but you can donate your car to support this station. Here's how.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We've been talking about the booming housing market today, but it's important to keep in mind that this story goes beyond concerns about getting into your dream house. The New York Times reporter Connor Doherty told us that the houses we build and buy and sell reveal a lot about us. Our values, the way we treat people, our own greed or generosity. Doherty wrote a book last year called Golden Gates. It's about the housing crisis in California, but there were themes in there we thought might apply to Utah or everywhere else right now. Doherty told us an important part of the story is how, throughout our recent history, the people who got a house in this country often made it difficult for others to get theirs.
If you think about it, you know, the kind of modern America is a post-World War II creation. And after the war, we had a ton of children, we had tremendous affluence, and Americans moved to the suburbs en masse. And it was somewhere around the 60s or 70s that we reached a situation in which most Americans live in the suburbs. That's a relatively new thing, and it takes a lot of space to do that. And it did lead to tremendous prosperity. But what happened was people started to get freaked out by the pace of development, the amount of resources needed for it. It started to feel as if your entire city would be paved over, every piece of natural beauty would be covered with houses. On top of that, it just gets expensive because you can only drive so far, and jobs do still tend to cluster. And so when you look at the kind of backlash to development that kind of made it very, very difficult to build housing in America, what you see is, obviously racism is a huge piece of it. That's one piece of it. Another piece of it is people just, I think that once people live in a neighborhood, they have a lot caught up in the idea that it either won't change or that they will have, you know, large say over exactly how and where it changes. And this is a value that I don't think we used to have. I think it's safe to say we've probably gone too far and that we've now created a situation where it's so difficult to build housing that we create more people who don't have housing at the very bottom of the rung. There's also just like a lot of waste, if you think about it. You know, there are so many people who spend so much money on housing, kind of unnecessarily. And there's so much productive capacity, you know, money that could be going towards investments or education, or somebody could have a little bit more money and take a risk and start their own business. You know, there's just so many opportunities that are foregone because we're spending so much money on housing. And whenever I link the high cost of housing and rising homelessness, people say, look, this is crazy. It's not true that if, you know, home prices go from $600,000 to $700,000, a bunch of people become homeless, right? You know, because they're sort of saying it's not like a family is going to buy, you know, a $600,000 house and then it escalates out of their price range and they just like go sleep on it in a tent, you know? So, And I say, of course, that's not true. But we do have one kind of contiguous land market. It has its segments, but they bleed into each other, right? And when housing is so expensive, it becomes very expensive at the bottom as well. You know, there is this kind of crowding thing that happens. So I guess what I'm saying is there is this cascading effect where when everything becomes expensive, people start to redevelop the land for other more expensive uses, and the kind of bottom drops out of the very cheap housing market. We are kind of all linked where we, I do feel comfortable saying, yes, as it gets more expensive, we do have more homelessness.
In your reporting, you describe the housing market as being split into these two tracks, and they're not parallel tracks. You have one group who, you know, they have savings, they're rushing to buy a house. And then you have another group that just cannot get into the market right now. They're being locked out, which raises the question. On one hand, you can say, oh, this is good for the economy. There's, you know, these rising values of houses are good. But on the other hand, it's very much not good for a lot of people. And one of the things you've also talked about is that most homeowners expect their homes to constantly go up in value. But you said you could look at this as, in fact, a corrosive value. So say a little more about that, if you would.
So somewhere around the 1970s, home prices started getting mentioned a lot in newspapers. And at some point, they outpaced stock prices. That was the period when people became not only very defensive of their homes and their neighborhoods, but they also started to recognize that those homes could be an investment. But when we start to see home values as our pension funds, as many people do, or we start to see home values as a way to make a considerable amount of money, I think that when we start to see a home as an investment instead of a place to live, I think that we start to create a problem, because if your home goes up a lot in value, it's obviously more difficult for the next generation to get in, right? And you sort of create this cycle where we are making shelter a basic necessity. I mean, this is not a tech stock. This is not a bauble. This is not a jewel. This is not a piece of fine art. This is shelter that we need for our society to operate. When we start treating shelter as an investment that needs to sort of be protected and pumped up in value as much as possible, I think that we start to have shelter problems, as we do in America today, right? And shelter is a basic necessity.
You know, that's the question that interested us, is how is this going to change, you know, the culture? How's it going to change American society? What does a period like this mean? And one of the things you've said is that most of the gaps in society, you know, wealth inequality, education, racial disparity, that's all a housing gap.
Yes, I think so. I have here on my bookshelf an excellent book called Crabgrass Frontier, and it's a history of the suburbs in America. And I'm going to just read to you the first line of this book. It says, "Throughout history, the treatment and arrangement of shelter have revealed more about a particular people than have any other products of the creative arts. Housing is an outward expression of the inner human nature. No society can be fully understood apart from the residences of its members." I read that line a lot, and I think about that line a lot. I sort of see that as the organizing principle for all my work, that when we are talking about housing, you're talking about us. You're talking about how we organize our society. You're talking about what we aspire to. I mean, think of how hard people work. Think of how they define their entire lives around getting a particular house or getting to a particular neighborhood. A lot of times they write about development battles where a particular suburb is being asked to allow, say, you know, apartment buildings or something like that, right? And I will talk to angry neighbors, and one of the things I frequently hear from people is, I worked so hard to get here, you know, that I used to live, you know, in this other suburb and it wasn't as nice, and I wanted to get to this place with these schools. You listen to people talk and they will go on for a half hour just about how basically their whole life, their choice of career, their how they saved was all basically a ploy to get to that place. So our society is completely built sociologically, financially, around homes and neighborhoods and sort of where we do what. And so it's not surprising then that all of our kind of inequities, all of our prejudices are revealed through housing. Hmm. So I think that the way we're going to have to get out of this is build more housing and make it easier to get to opportunity. Hmm. What one thing that freaks a lot of people out is they sort of think, well, you know, I have a home and it's now worth many hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars or $1 million. And this is now my retirement plan. What am I going to do? We can't just go backwards. This was the system I bought into.
Yeah.
This is, but I don't think it has to be that way. For starters, there's a lot of opportunities that come from having a better society. There's a lot of economic growth opportunities that we're, you know, this is a common refrain amongst economists, but we always sort of overvalue our fear of losses and undervalue our kind of the opportunities we don't seize, right? So there's a huge opportunity to be seized here for better education, better human capital, more companies. You know, I mean, having a more enriched, more equal society could lead to all sorts of new sorts of innovations that we have not contemplated, right? That's more likely than not.
It seems like, Connor, that in order to get there to that point, that there's going to have to be a kind of shift in values or a shift in attitude. People are going to have to acknowledge that, you know, I'm thinking about the West, for example. They're going to have to acknowledge the reality of higher density. They're going to have to acknowledge the reality of maybe there will be mother-in-law, you know, apartments in people's houses in your neighborhood that you had resisted in the past. Maybe you're going to have to rethink the idea of, again, density and open space. It seems like that to get there, there's going to have to be the expectation is going to have to change. And the attitude is going to have to change in some way. Does that seem right?
That seems 100% spot on. And I think that's already happening. Huh. You know, one of the things I talk a lot about in my book is this generational conflict between people who call themselves YIMBYs, which stands for Yes in My Backyard, and people who are branded but never call themselves NIMBYs, which stands for Not in My Backyard. And you meet a lot of these, particularly in the Bay Area, in the, you know, you meet people who are very anti-development. A lot of them are kind of typical baby boomers in that they grew up in the 60s and 70s, they very much associated with the environmental movement. You know, they sort of saw preserving open space and a lot of those values as values that they held for the rest of their life. They see the Sierra Club next to anything on their ballot and they don't even read it. They just endorse, you know, they endorsed it. Boom, I'm voting for that, right? So fighting the forces of development, fighting the kind of imposition of freeways, this was a righteous cause that they fought as younger people and held as a value for the rest of their life. Hmm. When you look at these YIMBYs, they have seen density as very central to battling climate change. Yeah. They're very aware of past sins like redlining and the kind of corrosive social and consequences of that. You know, they have a huge optimism about bike lanes, you know, about changes that might make the world easier to navigate. And so they have absorbed building more housing as a value. And I think that that will hold.
Hmm. So it sounds like you sound, I have to say, cautiously optimistic.
One of the things people ask me is, what will a neighborhood look like? Wouldn't it be so crazy if we had apartment buildings or small apartment buildings next to single family homes? If you think about it, zoning and these single family, they kind of become our DNA. They kind of become our sense of what's right, what's orderly. And it's almost like the way you would not wear, like, you know, shorts and a tuxedo or something like that. People just sort of say, oh my God, what would it look like if you had a tall house next to a small, you know? And what I say to people is, just go drive around your city. Go drive around any city in America in the first neighborhood outside of downtown. And everywhere you go, you will find a neighborhood that has a mix of single family homes, but with like smaller apartment buildings on the corner. You'll see duplexes mixed in with homes, right? And I've been to Salt Lake, but I can't identify the neighborhood in Salt Lake that's like that, but I know there is one, right? Another image I always point to people is think about the Painted Ladies in San Francisco. The Painted Ladies are that iconic row of homes that were the intro for the show Full House. It's, I think, six or seven homes going down a hill in Alamo Square. But if you go to that actual place and you stand in that park and you try to recreate that picture for yourself with your camera, you will find that there is like a seven-story apartment building butting up against the uppermost home. And it is always cropped out of the picture. So I guess what I'm saying is that this is not some weird, insane, complete paradigm shift we have to go through, because we've gone through it before. This was how we used to do it. I think that's perfectly healthy, perfectly reasonable, and perfectly achievable without massive dislocation or change.
Connor Doherty, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Connor Doherty is an economics reporter at the New York Times. His book is Golden Gates: The Housing Crisis and a Reckoning for the American Dream. It's now out on paperback. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and reach out when you have a chance. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Carter Wolf, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.